Good afternoon. I know we're in the midst of finding our way into our seats. This is an extraordinary day in a couple of respects. One, we are celebrating the largest one-day snowfall in the history of Dallas. That alone is worth noting. Number two, we have seen a lot of beautiful trees turn into toothpicks overnight, and there's a sadness about that. And it's troubling that all over the area, all over the region, there are, at least by the website I checked, 206,000 people served by Oncor who are without power, and many of them are our friends and neighbors, and some of them are people here in the room. Yes, Mr. Croft apparently came not only to enjoy the symposium, but to get warm. But it's an extraordinary day because of the occasion that it brings us together, and that's the visit of a marvelous scholar and communicator, Dr. Ron White, and the opportunity for a panel discussion. Some of you, I know, are aware of Dr. White's background. Briefly, let me point out that his biography of Abraham Lincoln is an amazing achievement, and we are privileged to have become acquainted with the book and also to have him with us. So I want you to welcome, first of all, our very distinguished guest and scholar, Dr. Ron White. Now, I also want to introduce to you the two panelists who will be responding to Dr. White's presentation this afternoon. In the middle is Dr. Rebecca Miles. Becca is a member of the faculty at Perkins School of Theology. She is Associate Professor of Christian Ethics. She's an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church, a clergy member of the Arkansas Annual Conference, an active leader in many respects in the church and in discussions of issues of public ethics. And I am delighted that Becca is with us. Thank you. And also responding is another faculty member at Southern Methodist University, Dr. Charles Curran. Charlie, as his friends know him, and one or two of his enemies probably as well, Charlie is a gracious presence here in the Perkins community, and although we cannot count him formally as a member of the faculty of this School of Theology, he is very much a friend and partner with us in the common endeavors that we have. He holds the Scurlock Chair in Ethics and is a university distinguished professor. That title alone indicates not only his stature, but it also means he has a certain amount of freedom to teach in whatever part of the university he wants. Charlie, you have been on a sabbatical or now are? So he's now gainfully employed again. All right. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Charles Curran. Now, the procedure, without further explanation, is that Dr. White will make a presentation, and then the two respondents will speak, and then we will engage in open conversation. We certainly recognize that this room would be much more thoroughly filled. But the circumstances of which we are all aware have certainly inhibited travel. Many people are confined to their homes because they're waiting for the power to come back on. But I know that we're looking forward to the discussion, first by Dr. White, then by the respondents, and then in open forum. We'll begin with Dr. White. Thank you.
Good afternoon to those of you that I'm meeting for the first time. Am I all right with the mic? Okay. And thank you for the bravery of coming a second time through ice, wind, and snow. Kind of an unusual set of two lectures. You might have thought that maybe the first one would have set the broader context, but we decided to focus at our luncheon meeting on the second inaugural address. Now, in the second presentation, I want to sort of address the larger issue of Lincoln's remarkable faith journey, his religious odyssey. So if I may, I'd like to speak to that, and we'll welcome the respondents. The Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial of 2009 shone a bright light on Abraham Lincoln. Almost every aspect of this rough-hewn man with less than 1 year of formal education was lifted up. We've discovered a lot of Lincoln legal documents, Lincoln the lawyer. I found myself surprised to myself. I wrote a lot about Lincoln the commander-in-chief, many aspects of his life. President Barack Obama has helped shine an even brighter light on Abraham Lincoln. And as I read both of his books, it was clear to me that this was not, as Everett Dirksen said in the 1950s, every politician wants to get right with Lincoln, but that Obama had really studied carefully Abraham Lincoln. But for all of the attention, all of the windows lifted up, I want to suggest this afternoon that Lincoln's religious odyssey, his faith journey, still remains in the shadows. This faith journey has either been overlooked or it's been misunderstood. Born in Kentucky in 1809, Lincoln grew to young manhood in Indiana, where his father, stepmother, and sister all became members of the Little Pigeon Baptist Church. He did not. Very unusual for a family in the 19th century. As a boy, Lincoln mimicked the sermons of the Baptist preachers that he knew. As a teenager, he pushed against a tradition that I think he believed did not allow him to ask the searching questions that were already developing in his young mind. As a 20-something, he lived in the village of New Salem in Illinois. He read Enlightenment critics of revealed religion and became a skeptic. Multiple witnesses from New Salem report that Lincoln actually wrote a paper attacking Christianity and the Bible, and on one particular evening as he was reading the paper, one of his best friends tore the paper out of his hand and threw it into the fire. In a sense, this is not a smart thing to do for a young politician, to attack Orthodox Christianity. Lincoln eventually became a fatalist. Fatalism is a kissing cousin of deism, the deism of Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, a deism where Jefferson embraced a creator God, but not a redeemer God, a God who sets the world in motion, kind of a watchmaker, clockmaker God, but does not actively participate in it. Modern biographers have focused on fatalism to understand Lincoln's religious thought. Fatalism is the belief that all events take place in accordance with unvarying laws of causation. The popular expression of fatalism is, whatever happens is bound to happen. The form of fatalism that Lincoln encountered in the early 19th century asked him to resign himself to a course of events outside of his control. Stephen B. Oates, every generation has sort of had its Lincoln biographies. Benjamin Thomas in the 1950s wrote a great Lincoln biography. Stephen B. Oates in 1977 wrote With Malice Toward None, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. And he described Lincoln as, quote, a religious fatalist like his mother. David Herbert Donald in his biography of 1995, Lincoln, invoked Lincoln's fatalism to support his thesis of, quote, Lincoln's reluctance to take the initiative and make bold plans. Donald argues that Lincoln, from his earliest days, quote, had a sense that his destiny was controlled by some larger force, some higher power. And there, the Lincoln religious story stops. Now, it's interesting. Lincoln's political thought is characterized by almost everyone as a man who was capable of changing his mind. And yet, when we come to Lincoln's religious views, he is portrayed as a man whose views are frozen in time. What he decided in when he was 25 was the same belief when he was 55. Just in talking to the pastors in the audience, we know that is not true. We are all on a pilgrimage. But Lincoln became involved in a remarkable religious odyssey that would not come into full public view, I suggest, until 41 days before his assassination. his second inaugural address. And, you know, we look back at Lincoln and we sort of see, well, that's the end of his life. This wasn't the end of his life to his point of view. This was the beginning of the second term. And gamblers in the street were betting he would be elected for a third term and serve all the way to March 1873. So this was his platform, the second inaugural. What more might he have said? It's often pointed out that Lincoln never joined a church, but this observation overlooks the fact that he attended two Presbyterian churches. At the death of Eddie Lincoln, before he was the age of four, in 1850, Abraham and Mary Lincoln invited James Smith, the new pastor at First Presbyterian Church in Springfield, to conduct the funeral for their son. Touched by Smith's pastoral ministry, Mary Lincoln joined the Presbyterian Church. She had been an Episcopalian. She joined, interesting the phrase in the session minutes, by examination. A lot more difficult to join the church in the 19th century, by examination. And the Lincolns rented a pew for $50 a year. In the spring of 1853, just 1 year later, Lincoln accepted an invitation from First Presbyterian Church to be one of three lawyers to represent it in a suit in the Sangamon Presbytery. We Presbyterians are often involved in suits and judicial cases. The Presbytery, by its own polity, would not have allowed Lincoln to be a representative lawyer if they had not understood that in some way he was associated with First Presbyterian Church. Interestingly, as a young man, James Smith, the pastor, followed a path not unlike Lincoln. Born in Scotland, he was attracted to the ideas of the Enlightenment thinkers Constantine Volney and Thomas Paine. He became, in his own words, a fatalist, deist. After migrating to the United States as a young man, he took pleasure in challenging the religious ideas of the revivalists in southern Indiana where he lived. But one day, upon listening to a Cumberland Presbyterian minister, Smith experienced conversion. Smith then traveled his own religious odyssey from deism through the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, a church very much part of the revivalistic spirit of that age, to the more rational old school Presbyterian tradition. The Presbyterian Church had divided in 1837 over a number of theological, political, and organizational issues into two denominations, old and new school. The Methodists would divide. The Baptists would divide. And Lincoln, once upon a time, named all three of those divisions as the precursor of what he feared would take place in this nation. In the early 1850s, Smith gave Lincoln a copy of his book, The Christian's Defense, a long treatise on the authority of the Bible that grew out of debates with Charles Olmsted. If I complain that I'm speaking twice a day, he debated Olmsted for 18 consecutive evenings. 18. Robert Lincoln, the eldest son, remembered that Smith's book was on the bookshelf at the Lincoln home at 8th and Jackson in Springfield. Smith quickly developed a reputation in Springfield for learned preaching. Lincoln, who all his life was critical of a reliance on emotion in both religion and politics, would have agreed with Smith's proposal that in matters of faith, quote, the exercises of the understanding must be separated from the tendencies of the fancy or of the heart, a reference to the emotional revivalism from which Smith was just then emerging. Lincoln, who as a youth had reacted against both his father and his father's faith tradition, now, after the death of his son, began the slow journey to reclaim something of his religious past. But it could never be the demonstrative Baptist tradition of his parents. He could have not said it better than Pastor Smith. Quote, everything must be given up to the supremacy of argument. Argument. When the Lincolns arrived in Washington in 1861, a number of churches invited them to attend worship. First Presbyterian, the Church of the Presidents, offered themselves no pew rent, free pew. Lincoln, however, turned down that invitation and went to New York Avenue Presbyterian Church the very first Sunday after his inauguration, an old school Presbyterian church. As in Springfield, again, the Lincolns chose an old school church. In A. Lincoln, the biography I've written, I tell the story of Phineas Densmore Gurley, the minister at New York Avenue, who I believe is the missing person in the Lincoln story. A fine-looking man of large frame and voice, Gurley had graduated first in his class from Princeton Theological Seminary in 1840, where he was a student of Charles Hodge. Hodge was just in his seventh year of teaching when Gurley began. Hodge would teach 52 years at Princeton Seminary. I don't know if anybody's matched that, Dr. Furnish. And, of course, and you will enjoy this, Hodge is good for a good laugh because at his retirement banquet, he stood and said, "I am proud to say there has not been a new idea at Princeton Seminary in 50 years. What he meant was he was defending the Calvinism, the tradition of the Presbyterian Church. When asked about what I discovered in the Princeton Seminary archives, and don't think anybody else had seen this, was in 1860, Princeton Seminary faculty sent a letter to Gurley and told him they were very interested in him coming back to join the faculty, to head up the preaching and pastoral department, a recognition of the eminence of this man. Well, he stayed, and there he was to greet Abraham Lincoln when he arrived as president. When asked about Gurley and his sermons, Lincoln is said to have replied, "I like Gurley. He don't preach politics. I get enough of that through the week." The new school was the ones that were involved in anti-slavery. The old school believed the church was a spiritual institution, should not be involved in quote-unquote political questions. A fellow minister described Gurley's ministry as, quote, "Calvinism presented in his beautiful examples and spirit and preaching." The death of a second son, Willie Lincoln, at age 11, the boy most like the father in February 1862, proved to be a decisive turning point in Lincoln's religious odyssey. He invited Gurley to conduct the funeral sermon in the White House. Gurley was a preacher who asked questions in his sermons. In this funeral oration, he addressed the delicate balance between free will and determinism. The Presbyterian minister said to the grieving parents, "It is well for us and very comforting on such an occasion to get a clear and scriptural view of the providence of God." He acknowledged the perplexity of providence, calling it a mysterious dealing. Gurley pointed Lincoln to a divine providence where, quote, "His kingdom ruleth all." Gurley, in the spirit of Hodge, was not announcing some wooden, arbitrary providence. In his final words of comfort, Gurley invited the president to, quote, "bow in his presence with a humble and teachable spirit. Only let us be still and know that he is God." And Lincoln asked Gurley for a copy of the sermon. The sermon was printed and distributed widely, and Lincoln carried that copy of that sermon around with him. Well, in the few attempts to chart Lincoln's faith journey, historians and biographers have constructed a straight line from fatalism to providence, as if these are just simply two different expressions of the same kind of determinism. No theologian or pastor in the 19th century would ever have made such a judgment. In 1859, Francis Wharton, an Episcopal minister who would become one of the first members of the new Episcopal faculty at Cambridge, Massachusetts after the Civil War, wrote a book, A Treatise on Theism and Modern Skeptical Theories, in which in Chapter 4 he characterized fatalism as, quote, "a distinct scheme of unbelief." Why? Because it failed to recognize the personality and action of a loving God. Wharton contrasted fatalism with the God of Christianity, he said, God is known by his watchful care and love. For Princeton Seminary's Hodge, the appreciation of the personality of God was the key to the distinction between providence and fatalism. Hodge argued, "This doctrine necessarily flows from the scriptural idea of God. He is declared to be a personal being, infinite in wisdom, goodness, and power." In his three-volume systematic theology, Hodge was really smart. He didn't publish this until the very end of his career. He didn't want his students reading his own systematic theology while he was giving his lecture. So he published it 50 years after he started, but these were his lectures. Hodge said of Providence, an infinitely wise, good, and powerful God is everywhere present, controlling all events, great and small, and necessary and free, in a way perfectly consistent with the nature of his creatures and with his own infinite excellence. In fatalism, events unfold according to certain laws of nature. In Christian theology, God's divine power is able to embrace both human freedom and responsibility. Interestingly, a clear statement of the meaning of providence and fatalism came on the occasion of the South remembering one of its greatest heroes. Stonewall Jackson was renowned as Robert E. Lee's right arm, but he was also a Presbyterian Sunday school teacher. Moses Drury Hoag, minister at the Second Presbyterian Church in Richmond, spoke at the unveiling of the statue of Jackson on October 26, 1876. Hoag, who had been a frequent correspondent with Charles Hodge, spoke at length about Jackson's abiding trust in Providence. He called Jackson's belief in Providence surely the primary fact, the supreme fact in the history of General Jackson. But then he added, I cannot leave the subject without adding that those who confound his faith in Providence with fatalism mistake both the spiritual history of the man and the meaning of the very words they employ. An overlooked and misunderstood signpost of Lincoln's religious odyssey occurred in the spring of 1864. Three leaders from Kentucky, including Governor Thomas Bramlett, upset with Lincoln, terribly upset. Bramlett wrote five letters to Lincoln, and when he couldn't get a satisfactory response, he traveled to Washington, upset because he claimed you are destroying the agriculture of the state of Kentucky by taking all of the slaves off the farms and putting them into the Union Army. He came to talk to Lincoln. Before they could say a word, Lincoln began with these words, not three men from Massachusetts, three men from Kentucky. I am naturally anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel. He went on to say, however, that I can't, as president, act on my own personal point of view. I'm still bound by a constitution. Lincoln's remarks so struck the visitors that one of them, editor Albert Hodges of the Frankfurt newspaper, returned to the White House requesting a copy of Lincoln's remarks. The president, telling Hodges that he spoke spontaneously, assured him he would send a letter within the week copying his quote-unquote little speech. When Hodges received Lincoln's letter, dated April 4, 1864, I made a typo there, dear correspondents, he was surprised to find that Lincoln concluded, I add a word which was not in my verbal conversation. David Donald, in his Wonderful Lincoln, chose one line from that paragraph as the epigraph of his entire biography. This is the line, I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Donald goes on to say in the preface, this biography highlights a basic trait of character evident throughout Lincoln's life, the essential passivity of his nature. Does this single sentence convey the essence of Lincoln's meaning in the final paragraph? Listen to the whole paragraph. I add a word which was not in the verbal conversation. In telling this tale, I attempt no compliment to my own sagacity. I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Now, at the end of 3 years' struggle, the nation's condition is not what either party or any man devised or expected. God alone can claim it. Whether it is attending seems plain. If not, God now wills the removal of a great wrong and wills that all we of the North, as well as you of the South, shall pay fairly for our complicity in that wrong, impartial history will find therein new cause to attest and revere the justice and the goodness of God. Those of us in this school of theology know the difference between exegesis and eisegesis and taking something out of context. If one reads the whole paragraph, it's clearly not about passivity. Lincoln, as if a lawyer in a courtroom, began his case with three negative statements. No compliment to my own sagacity. I claim not to have controlled events. The nation's condition is not what either party or any man devised or expected. But these negative assertions, exactly the way a lawyer would argue in the courtroom, let me admit my patient, the client might have been near the scene of the crime, building in crescendo, were meant to prompt the question, well, what or who was the source then of this activity? Lincoln answers with four affirmations. God alone can claim it. If God now wills the removal of a great wrong, wills that we of the North as well as you of the South shall pay fairly for our complicity in that wrong. And finally, what should be our response to this divine activity? To attest and revere the justice and the goodness of God. The larger point of Lincoln's brilliant letter to these three men was that Lincoln was quite willing to acknowledge his passivity as a way to emphasize the larger truth of the activity of God. Well, Lincoln's personal religious odyssey finally comes into full view in his remarkable second inaugural address. This was the subject of our luncheon conversation. In 701 words, Lincoln mentions God 14 times, quotes the Bible 4 times, invokes prayer 3 times. This address is not fatalism. Rather, it is, Gurley's words, a scriptural understanding of the providence of God, which Lincoln had now been listening to for 4 years at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church. The Almighty has his own purposes, Lincoln says in the second inaugural. At the exact architectural center of Lincoln's address, after discussing the different actors, the soldiers, the generals, Lincoln as commander-in-chief, in quick brush strokes, Lincoln describes God's activity. He now wills to remove. He gives to both North and South this terrible war. Yet if God wills that it continue. In Lincoln's much-loved Shakespeare, one needs to progress to Act 3 to understand the events and the dialogue of Act 1. Just so in the first and second paragraphs of the second inaugural, when Lincoln discussed these actions, he was really preparing his audience for the dramatic affirmation of the divine attributes of a living God, whom he declares to be the central actor. It's easy to skip over the word attributes. It's not a word in popular religious language today. But in Lincoln's day, I argue it was a very important word in Presbyterian circles. It was a word he now brings into the second inaugural. Who was this God who gives to both North and South? The theological affirmation that Lincoln is making was that divine attributes presume and define a living God. I argue that here Lincoln is using very technical language. In the Christian idea of providence, God is a personal living God. In fatalism, on the other hand, it's more oriented around the depersonalization of the concept of God. Well, it can be argued that when Lincoln speaks of those divine attributes, and you have this out in your hands now, let me ask you to take it up. This is in paragraph 3, about a little more than halfway down, before two-thirds of the way down in that paragraph. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Aha! But it's been suggested that Lincoln is not including himself in the circle of believers. Believers in a living God. In other words, he's using descriptive language, but not prescriptive language. But I believe this form of speech is perfectly consistent with the way Lincoln always talked. When asked to give some biographical information for his 1860 campaign, he always spoke in the third person. When he delivered his second inaugural address, he uses personal pronouns only in the first paragraph and thereupon directed all attention away from himself. None of these forms of speech were meant to suggest that Lincoln was not speaking from his own personal vantage point. Most likely, Lincoln heard Gurley speak of divine attributes. Any student of Hodge would have learned the language from the Princeton theologian. In Volume 1 of Systematic Theology, Hodge titled Chapter 5, The Nature and Attributes of God. He spent 80 pages making the case that attributes are, quote, essential to the nature of a divine being. Of course, Gurley and Hodge were building on the language of the Westminster Confession of Faith. English-speaking Presbyterians and many Baptists brought the Westminster Confession of Faith with them across the Atlantic at the beginning of the 17th century. The Westminster Confession functioned for Presbyterians as an authoritative interpretation of biblical faith. It was the way that catechisms or Christian education was taught in congregations. One of the sticking points in the division of 1837 was the old school's tenacity of holding on to the Westminster, whereas the new school wanted to be much more involved in theological innovation. Over and over again, the Westminster Confession is invoked. Chapter 2 of the Westminster, which would have been familiar to Lincoln, began with a discussion of the divine attributes of God. God was defined at the outset as the one living and true God, whose attributes include gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and love. At the same time, this God was most just and terrible in judgments. A person came up to me after the lunch this morning and commented that she was struck by the fact that there is this note of both redemption and judgment in Lincoln's second inaugural. We've kind of muted judgment in our own day, and that Lincoln is very willing and happy to employ both of these elements of God and God's personality. Lincoln, having sat in old-school Presbyterian congregations for more than 20 years, resorted to old-school language when he affirmed that believers would always ascribe certain attributes to God. All right, but I've been asked many times, and you need to ask this question if you've not thought of it already, might not Lincoln's words on the Bible, on God, and the second inaugural be nothing more than what a cultured person would offer in the middle of the 19th century? I've been asked, or usually told this by many in audiences, that Lincoln is doing nothing more, quote the Bible, quote Shakespeare, this is what a cultured person would do, or sharpening the focus, I have been asked, usually told, that Lincoln really is adopting the religious language of his audience, that this is not his language, but that he understands as a shrewd politician that Americans are a very deeply religious nation and he uses their language to speak to them. Well, how might we respond to these? Today, when you and I listen to politicians, is there any politician that dare not conclude a political address by saying, God bless America? God bless America. You can be Republican, Democrat, anything else. You must conclude that way. And we kind of wonder, or I do at times, how sincere is this person's invocation of religious values? Well, that's a fair question to ask Lincoln. Aha. But what we've missed in the Lincoln religious odyssey is the very way that he continually defined himself. In the collected Lincoln works, there are 125 what the editors called fragments. These fragments were little slips of paper, sometimes the back of a flap of an envelope, where Lincoln would sit and write out, always beginning with a problem. He had a number of them on slavery. The Republican Party, the charge that it was a sectional party. Is it a sectional party? All sorts of things in there. One of them was only found after his death. John Hay, his young secretary, went into his office, got down on his hands and knees, and as he was looking in the bottom drawer of his desk, he came out and found this remarkable document. If you'll turn the page on your handout, here it is. Lincoln never expected that we'd be reading this on the 201st anniversary of his birthday. He wrote it for his eyes only. I think it answers the question of the integrity of the public speech, because here's a private speech, if you will. It's really a reflection in which Lincoln is struggling with the question. Well, what is the question he's struggling with? May I read it? The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be, and one must be, wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time, the logical Lincoln. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities, working just as they do, are the best adaptation to effect his purpose. I'm almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet. By his mere quiet power, Lincoln didn't like noisy gods, by his mere quiet power on the minds of the now contestants, he could have either saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest. And having begun, he could give the final victory to either side any day. Yet the contest proceeds. How long do you think it took Lincoln to write that? I think it took him hours. I think he sat and brooded and reflected and pondered. And let me read one sentence a different way, if I may. I am almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest. Lincoln was so comfortable with ambiguity, and many of those with which we serve, because of our culture, do not want any ambiguity to be part of our religious faith. It's either got to be this or that, yes or no. And Lincoln is very comfortable with ambiguity as he struggles to discern God's actions in history. So unknown to people in Lincoln's day, this really, if you read the second inaugural, if you were present at lunch today, this is the main antecedent of Lincoln's second inaugural address. As many of those slips of paper were, it's as if he's been struggling with thinking about this, and it's all in private, and then in public, it finally comes into view. In my paper, and the respondents have it, but you don't, it's a little too awkward to read, I actually go through line by line to show the parallelism between the meditation on the divine will. That wasn't Lincoln's title. It was untitled. John Hay gave it that title. It wasn't dated. Lincoln never dated it. These were never meant to be seen. But oh, how much they tell us about Lincoln. In conclusion, I've been asked again and again whether I think it's possible in our increasingly multicultural and multireligious nation for a modern politician to speak today of a God who acts in history. After first acknowledging all of the problems and missteps of recent attempts to do so, I always answer in the affirmative. I believe that Lincoln's religious odyssey, marked by his humble bearing and his inclusive spirit, his biblical wisdom, and his careful balancing of justice and mercy, is a model for how we may attempt to speak about God in our own day. Thank you very much.
Has that got it? Can y'all hear me? Good. I'm happy to be a part of this event and an event honoring Fred Kearney as well. He was always so kind to me, and I'm proud to be in his line as a Christian ethicist here. And I can't get this in my pocket. I'll just stick it in here. Here we go. As a Christian ethicist at Perkins School of Theology, it's good to have these interactions with you and with Dr. White, and it's grateful to have a chance to return to reading about Abraham Lincoln. The first time I read Lincoln formally was with Martin Marty when I did a reading course with him at the University of Chicago, and then did an exam that was partly on Lincoln, really on religion and American public life. And this was 20 years ago. So now 20 years later, I'm coming back and looking at this, you know, very different time in my life and a very different time in the life of our country. And it's been interesting to me to see how my own views of Lincoln have changed in those 20 years, as you would expect they would. It's not surprising, really, to see changes in anyone's view about Lincoln, because there are so many different readings of Lincoln out there, and particularly of Lincoln's religious life. I've come to think of him really more than other historical figures as a kind of an ink blot. That is, our readings of Lincoln say something about who we are, about what we emphasize in our own lives. And you can really have him say any number of things. And there are many different pictures of Lincoln out there, and I've appreciated what Dr. White has done here and also in some of his writings and bringing some of those together and placing these different pictures of Lincoln in a way along a continuum of his own, the way he changed and developed over his own life. Some people emphasize Lincoln's family's religious heritage, either positively or negatively. You know, he was grew up in this sort of primitive Baptist context that he did not affirm in his own membership. But I don't know if y'all. I grew up. My best friend was primitive Baptist, and 20th century primitive Baptists like to see a continuity with 19th century primitive Baptists, except they like to think of themselves as even more primitive over time. So they were sort of out primitive Baptist, the primitive Baptist. So I would sometimes go to these congregations, but you know, so Lincoln's congregation and this kind of primitive Baptists were, you know, out Calvin the Calvinist. So which is hard to do, really. You know, that's as a Wesleyan, I really don't have any interest in Calvin the Calvinist, but. They, for example, didn't have mission societies or preaching missions because God's will, God would do what God would do, right? So God's will was set, and it would play out sort of inexorably over time, which is not really a key Wesleyan point of view. So in any case, you can see in Lincoln, in some ways, a rejection of this heritage. So he had, you know, conflict with his father, and his father had taken on and was a very important leader in this, the church they were part of. And you can see a rejection of this heritage. So a rejection of the denominational infighting between Methodists and various and sundry Baptists, and a rejection of some of the narrowness of some aspects of Protestantism of the time, of his own denomination and others. But I think you can also see this continuity, and I think you're right, fatalism is very different, but it's almost like that was a sort of step, in a kind of an odd sort of step away from, but still carrying on to that sort of hesitation about human freedom and about what humans can do to change the course of history. And then over time coming back in some ways to a more traditional, in many ways, a Calvinist notion of divine providence. So you have his own religious heritage. You also have old school Presbyterian, which I've learned a lot about over the last couple of weeks reading Dr. White. That's been fun to do. Because he was, even if he never joined, he was off and on attending and also influenced by these personal conversations with old school Presbyterians. One of the images that what's fun too about this is some people like Dr. White bring all these together. But you know, so for example, some of his friends from young adulthood, from when he was a young man in Springfield, really like to emphasize Lincoln the Freethinker, and would swear up and down that's what he believed until his death. They were adamant about that, and talk about his reading of Thomas Paine, and also interesting to there are a couple of books recently that talk about the influence that his reading as a lawyer, his in legal philosophy, had on his understanding of human freedom and of the divine will and these kinds of things. Another picture of Lincoln was Lincoln the mocker of religion, the scoffer. And so the Methodist revivalist Peter Cartwright tried to paint Lincoln with this brush when they were running against each other for Congress. And evidently in the first election, Lincoln had smeared Cartwright, and the second one, Cartwright smearing. Isn't that right? Something like that is smearing Lincoln. So Lincoln has this handbill that he publishes sort of defending himself against these charges of being a scoffer against religion. But some people have described the language of the handbill as Clinton-esque. I'm a Democrat, so this is not any anti-Democrat thing, but that is, he doesn't actually ever say that he's, you know, what he actually believes. So he says, I have never denied the truth of Scriptures. He doesn't say, I affirm the truth of Scriptures. He says, I have never denied the truth of Scriptures. Another picture of Lincoln is Lincoln the Psychic. So I read this last week in a book written by the spiritualist. Have you seen this? Lincoln the Psychic or something like that. Really interesting stuff. And some of the stories are stories that you see in mainstream scholarship about Lincoln's prophetic dreams and things that, you know, that people talk about. Lincoln had foretold things, some connections that Mary Lincoln had with some seances after their son's death that Lincoln might have been a part of at some point. Now, some of this seems to be some straightforward scholarship, and some of it seems might be stretching it a bit. But Mark Knoll, who's, you know, a serious historian, and a funny one too, but in any case, a serious historian, talked about the influence on Lincoln of frontier spirit. He was a frontier spiritualist who believed that signs, dreams, and portents foretold the future. There are other readings. There's the image that many had of Lincoln after his assassination on Good Friday as the Man of Sorrows, you know, another Christ figure. Evidently, many Jewish citizens after his assassination extolled him as Father Abraham, lifting him up as a model, as a leader. A number of pastors claimed that when he died, he was just a day or two away from professing Christ in their denomination. And so it's amazing how many churches he was planning to profess Christ in just a few days after his assassination. One Methodist revivalist even claimed that Abraham Lincoln had a Wesleyan conversion experience. And this is the one of the few theories that I absolutely reject out of hand. He did not have a Wesleyan bone in his body, but of course it's not the bone that's the issue, it's the will. And he didn't have that focus on the Wesley's focus on human freedom and on the will. It's not about what we do, it's about what God does, how we fulfill our roles as instruments of God's will. Of course, one way to understand the tension in Abraham Lincoln's statements about religion, and you touched on this, is his role as a politician. It's easy to imagine that he would have to carefully weigh his statements, not to deceive, but simply to be in the interest of public service, to say what you need to say, to, in a way, it's responsible rhetoric in a way, to convey what you need and the truth in a way that you can still get elected. There's a wonderful story that you may have heard when Lincoln is running for Congress again against Peter Cartwright, this Methodist revivalist and actually a good fist fighter too. He went to one of Cartwright's preaching services, which, you know, I would love to see politicians go to each other's preaching services. This would do a lot. So Cartwright, of course, gives an altar call, as every good Methodist pastor knows how to do, or at least the old ones anyway. So Cartwright says, and this is in Sandburg's biography, "All who desire to lead a new life, to give their hearts to God, go to heaven, please stand." So, you know, some stand. And he says, "And all who wish to go to hell, please stand." And one person, probably a scoffer of religion, stood. And Lincoln didn't stand, right? So Cartwright singles him out. And he says, "I observed that many responded to the first invitation to give their hearts to God and go to heaven. And I further observe that all of you, save one, indicated that you do not desire to go to hell. The sole exception is Mr. Lincoln, who did not respond to either invitation. May I inquire of you, Mr. Lincoln, where are you going?" So Lincoln stands up and he says, "I came here as a respectful listener. I did not know that I was to be singled out by Brother Cartwright. Brother Cartwright asks me directly where I am going, and I desire to reply with equal directness, I am going to Congress." Now, many statements of Lincoln's on religion, you could read them as the statements of somebody who was going to Congress, who was going to Washington, to the White House, to the House. And I'm sure there's some truth to that he did weigh and tailor some of his statements, but it seems to me it's more complex than that. So the question is, how do you account for all these different readings? And one of the things I've found helpful in Dr. White's work is the way he lays this out, where he talks about not only did Lincoln change in terms of his understanding of politics, but also he changed theologically, as you would expect a person would over time, so that you can see that there is some continuity, that you could have somebody who was a fatalist and then who started out as a Calvinist but was hesitant about his denomination and these tensions with his father. You could see how all these different things would happen. Mark Knoll also talks about his identity as a poor person, as a person growing up in a very difficult context, and the way that piety shaped the family, even if he didn't buy into and become a member of the actual denomination. You can see also, and I think many people will emphasize this, the way that his the tragedies of his life, the despair of his life shaped him. So the early death of his mother, the death of his only surviving sibling, his sister, the death of two sons, and particularly of the second son, Eddie, who was 11, in the middle of the Civil War. And also just the burden of the Civil War itself and the decisions that he had to make and just the brutality of it, the many deaths of it, that all these things went into shape who he was and his own, as well as these dreams and visions that he appears to have had and these personal experiences with God. Mark Knowles says about these difficult experiences that they offered him an instruction in reality by the coldest master, death. These crises, he writes, left Lincoln no taste for easy believism, no escape from the mysteries of God and the universe. The extraordinary thing for me about Lincoln is not that you can read him in these different ways or that you can see how he changed over time. That seems to be the normal course of things. But the amazing thing to me is that you could put all this together, right, these changes over time and this development and all these different pieces of his life, and come out with somebody who was so theologically sophisticated as what you read in that second inaugural address and the meditation on the divine will that Dr. White was just telling us about. There's been a lot of talk about this among theologians and scholars of religion. When Martin Marty was asked to pick one thing to put in the National Millennium Time Capsule a decade ago, he said, "I'd choose a copy of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural as the one artifact or idea, so from American history, U.S. history, to preserve for people who long from now would want to find out about what we were at our best. This speech encapsulates what I, as a scholar of American history and religion, think is the best fusion of politics, faith, and hope." Mark Knoll talks about this second inaugural as the address that stands as the most remarkably Christian public statement by any American president. And really, it isn't so extraordinary simply by comparison with other presidential statements. It's also extraordinary by comparison with statements of the time by professional theologians, by pastors, by theologians of the time who really had these, even if they wrote brilliant things on other topics, once they got to talking about the Civil War, they could not see beyond. They're from the North. It's all the fault of these Southern leaders who are, scoundrels and scallywags. I guess it's the scallywags from the North. I don't know. Or the Southern ones. It's all the fault. But they had a very sort of limited sense of imagination about how they could describe what it was that was happening and how God was working in these times. And in comparison to what was going on at the time, it really is extraordinary the kinds of statements the kinds of things that you see, the theological reflection that you see by Lincoln in this second inaugural address, in a couple of letters, and as well as in this meditation on the divine will. This is Mark Knoll, a quote. "How was it that this man who never joined a church and who read only a little theology could give expression to profound theological interpretations of the war between the states, especially," he says, "when the revered theologians, the professional theologians of the time, the leading preachers of the time, were," this is a quote again, "able to offer so little of theological profundity." Again, "How could Lincoln point to the commanding sovereignty of a great God while professional clerics spoke almost exclusively of a house God, completely in league with the North of the South? How could such a profound grasp of God's grandeur come from an ordinary lawyer and politician who during his lifetime was scorned for his lack of culture?" It's not simply, I think, the greatness or the eloquence of the speech, but it's also just the profound theological depth of the second inaugural of these other writings. Knoll, writing on this meditation on divine will, says, "Like a figure from Israel's ancient history, Lincoln was arguing with God, but it was no longer a domesticated deity, an American God, but the ruler of the nations. The truth had not begun to dawn to Lincoln that this, God was not a God at the nation's beck and call, but the nation at his." You can see what Martin Marty meant when he said that Lincoln was sometimes looked like the only Protestant left on the scene. Marty adds, "Lincoln could not prove that his cause was God's. He wanted, himself and others, to try to conform to what they knew of God's will rather than to claim God for theirs." After writing this exam with Mark Marty 20 years ago, I wrote a dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr. So it's fun to go back and read, and I've recently doing a course with some students who were reading Niebuhr last week. So it's interesting for me to go back and see how Niebuhrian Lincoln sounds, or how Lincolnian Niebuhr sounds. I'm not sure. So I got to thinking, you know, somebody surely noticed this, right? So I Googled, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr and Abraham Lincoln, wondering, and I found this really funny exchange on Krista Tippett, Speaking of Faith, right? It's an exchange between E.J. Dion and David Brooke. It's about Obama and Niebuhr and sort of their tragic view of human nature, of politics, and so on. So Brooks writes, so this is David Brooks, or he says, you know, I've always thought that one of the presidents who learned the most from Niebuhr was Abraham Lincoln. He must have read Reinhold Niebuhr quite a lot, so then everybody's laughing. E.J. Dion says, yeah, Lincoln quoted him a lot on television. David Brooks says, yeah, I think he did. Well, I was actually interviewing Lincoln the other afternoon about Reinhold Niebuhr when, anyway, they all laugh. But I've been thinking about this this question of what happened with Lincoln. For Noel, it was these circumstances, these tragedies that drove him to this place, to what he calls a deeper contemplation of God and the divine will. The external Lincoln, casual about religious observance, hid a man of profound morality, an almost unbearable God consciousness, and a deep belief in the freedom of God to transcend the limited vision of humanity. Such religious qualities are unusual in any age. They were even more rare in the period of the Civil War, when for almost everyone else, partisan passion transformed God from the Lord of Nations into the servant of the North and the South. Now, I asked a question of Dr. White at lunch, and that is, why is it that all these professional theologians couldn't think of anything very profound to say, right? I mean, it's really predictable things. And then you have this fellow who wasn't a member of a church. He was really sporadic. He didn't go to church, but was sporadic and didn't read a lot of theology, who comes up with this really extraordinary statement of what God is doing in this situation. So I've been thinking about this afternoon, and what occurs to me is really the extraordinary thing is not that Lincoln did this, but that Marty and Noel and I and so many other theologians, professional theologians, are so surprised that the deepest theology would come not from the professional theologians, the professional clerics, but from a political leader, from people from other walks of life. And I'm sorry that Dodie Crockett just left, because I was thinking about her comment that she made when she introduced things at lunch today. And that is, you know, a lot of us think of Perkins as the place where our primary task is preparing women and men for leadership in Christian ministry, and most often it's for ordained ministry. But I think, you know, in this context, I think, too, about what kind of leadership do we provide here and other theological schools as well? How do we provide leadership for people who are not ordained, people who are in all walks of life, who are political leaders, who are, what did she say, wealth managers, wealth management in economic life, business leaders, and that it really shouldn't be that big a surprise to professional theologians, to pastors, when these extraordinary statements of theology come not from those of us who do this for a living, for a profession, but from those who are part of all walks of life. And I think that's something that you can see in a way in Niebuhr, too, who has never had a PhD. He started out as a pastor, an activist, and you can certainly see that in Lincoln. And I think that gives me, I'm sorry Dodie's gone, because that gives me, I think, a different vision for what she was trying to say today at lunch. So this has been a great fun for me. And I could go on and on about just sort of trying to sort of do an ink blot on myself about how my interpretation of Lincoln has changed. But I'll stop here and just thank Dr. White for what he's done. And I've been working on three books of his about I see you want this microphone about Niebuhr, and also thanks to you for the pleasure of returning to this material. So thank you very much.
Like Dr. Miles, I too am very pleased and honored to be a part of this symposium today, and again for the same two reasons that she gave. First, as we know, this symposium is the first public life, private faith lecture sponsored in honor of Fred Kearney, sponsored by his wife Kim and his sons and family, and Fred Kearney is someone whom I knew since the 1960s, and he was very influential, frankly, in my coming here to SMU 20 years ago. And he and Kim were most hospitable to me when I came and since. And the second reason to be grateful, obviously, is the fact that we can learn and have learned so much from Dr. White and what he has told us about Lincoln, not only in his oral presentation, but in his many written words on the subject. And I am going to take my response or start my response from what Dr. White said at the very end of his presentation, when he asked the question of how would politicians raise this question today or speak about the will of God. I will expand it a little bit, not only to politicians, but maybe in keeping with my colleague, Dr. Miles, also how should theologians, pastors, and even citizens understand how God is working in our public life today. Quite frankly, I am not a Lincoln scholar. I have sat and learned. My colleague Becca is amazing. I knew she knew moral theology and Christian ethics. I didn't know she was a Lincoln scholar on the side. Fools go in where angels fear to tread or something. I can't go that direction at all. So I am going to look at this from my perspective of Christian ethics and taking off, though, from the remark that Dr. White made at the end of his paper, namely, how should we try to understand how God works in our history? And I want to develop my thought in two major points. The first point is to say that the major problem today, I think, is not what Dr. White addressed as the major problem in Lincoln interpretation. That problem was Lincoln a fatalist or a believer in providence? I think today the issue, you know, for all of us is somewhat different. And let me phrase what I see as the problem with many people today. The problem with many people, politicians, pastors, theologians, ordinary citizens, believers, is the fact that people too often claim too much certitude with regard to what God is doing in our world. And I'm an equal opportunity employer. I'm against both the left and the right, using the fact that they claim to know precisely, exactly, and with great certitude what God is doing in our world. That will be my first point. And my second point will be, I think that I am not alone in saying this. I think I now have the backing of Abraham Lincoln, Ron White, and Becca Miles to go along with it. All right, so the first point, then, my fear today is that people too readily, too quickly, and with too great certitude claim to know what God is doing in our world. Quite frankly, I think that the whole illustration from the culture wars is a part of this. People screaming at one another, the nonpartisan kinds of way of everybody being absolutely certain that God is on their side. Okay. That what I want to do is give three illustrations of this. The first one is this. That the strongest argument for any believer is the fact that God wills it. Let's face it, God is Trump. What argument can go against it? If God is for it, who can be against it, right? All right. So God ultimately then is Trump. So the great temptation for all of us then is to use God for our purposes, to use God to support my positions, to put the engine of God behind my own way of looking at things. A good illustration of this, with which I think many of us are familiar, is Dr. White talked about, the danger of eisegesis, of reading into the scripture. All you have to do is look at some of the portraits of Jesus down through the centuries, even. Jesus has been a capitalist. Jesus has been a socialist. Jesus has been a model obedient citizen. Jesus has been a revolutionary. Jesus has been a pacifist. Jesus has been a revolutionary, a violent revolutionary. Everybody wants Jesus on her or his side. And I think I'm in the Presbyterians for some reason today, with Dr. White and Lincoln, and let me bring in another out of that tradition, Karl Barth. It was Karl Barth who reminded us years ago that the great temptation of Christians is to make God into our image and likeness. Instead of our being made in the image of God, we are tempted to make God into our image and likeness. And I think all of us have to admit that one way or another. For most of my life, I thought God was a good-looking white male like me. Well, the great danger that we make God into our image and likeness. But what Barth was getting at was the importance of the transcendence of God. God is God and is greater and bigger and more transcendent than any of us or all of us together. And God's ways are not necessarily our ways. That there is the great danger of claiming that we can know with great certitude what God is doing in our world. So a second illustration or example of this thesis, the fact that in times of crisis, times of war, or the 9/11 crisis, the great temptation for us all is that ultimately to say that God is on our side. Again, reference was made earlier. I don't think there has been a Democrat or a Republican president who has not always assumed that in every war we fought, God was on our side. And but as a result of that, then, it is so easy to demonize the enemy. We are all perfect, all holy and good, and the warriors of God. And over here is evil, the devil, and people who are all bad. It is so easy for us then to demonize the enemy because we are the agents of God doing God's work in the world. My third illustration. I come out of the Roman Catholic tradition, but I must say I cringe when I look back at the Crusades. Here we claim to be carrying out the will of God against the infidels, who then ruled the Holy Land. But in the name of God, the Crusaders did many horrible things. The danger is, if you think you're doing the will of God, you can do anything to achieve that end. But the crusading mentality and the concept still lies deep in the bones of many Christians. That a good example of this is Dwight Eisenhower, who was only baptized, confirmed, and became a communicant in the Presbyterian Church in February 1953. But before that, he wrote his famous book as the commander of the Allied forces in Europe on his experience. And what was the book called? Crusade in Europe. Once again, it was evident we were God's people doing God's will. Now, I believe that the Second World War, as people refer to today, was the good war. I think it was justified. But I don't think everything we did in that war was justified. Uh-oh. Maybe God, that's God's will. I mean, God has more power in this building than the dean. That, for example, the saturation bombing of cities, the atomic bomb, we killed innocent civilians. The demand for unconditional surrender. We prolong the war and the horrors of it. In the end, interestingly enough, we were most generous toward the Germans and the Japanese. And we were, but unfortunately, we demanded beforehand unconditional surrender. And we could have stopped that horror earlier than we did. But the danger of the crusading mentality, if this is God's will, then everything that we do is perfect and right. So, I think I have tried to indicate that in my judgment, there is this strong temptation when we talk about the providence of God and us as believers to have too much certitude about what God is doing in our world. A couple of years ago, Margaret Farley of Yale University wrote an article, and the title of it was, or the part of the title of it was, The Grace of Self-Doubt. And what she was getting at in that article was the epistemic humility. Our epistemic humility, which is ultimately grounded in the transcendence and the otherness of God. And Margaret's own mentor and good friend, James M. Gustafson, who is probably the best Christian ethicist that we produced in this country in the last part of the 20th century, took this concept of the grace of self-doubt and used it as the subtitle of his last book, An Examined Faith, The Grace of Self-Doubt. Because Gustafson here again strongly objects to politically and religiously exaggerated rhetorical claims to know the purposes of God. In the very last lines of his book, quote Lincoln, quote, "The Almighty has his own purposes. God will be God." Now that then brings me to my second point. I think that, as we learned so well from Dr. White, that Lincoln moved from his fatalism to his belief in providence. But Lincoln's belief in providence also made him recognize that one cannot know with too great certitude the will of God for what's happening in our world. And that, let me illustrate this from some of the things that were talked about in the talk that Dr. White gave us and from some of the documents that he cited. As the second inaugural phrase, that the Almighty has his purposes. And the whole context of that shows that we do not know exactly what his purposes are, and we don't know precisely how they will be carried out. I quote, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may quickly pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue, until the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn from the lash shall be paid by another drawn from the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said today, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Close quote. We don't know what God's will and intention is. That same basic understanding is found in the lecture, in the letter that Dr. White mentioned of Lincoln on April 4, 1865 to Albert Hodges. Quote, "Now at the end of 3 years struggle, the nation's condition is not what either party or any man or devised or expected. God alone can claim it." See, God has claimed it. With all our processes, well, maybe not. Maybe Todd has powers I don't know of. All right. But also then, Lincoln refused to demonize the enemy and to paint his own cause as totally righteous. Again, Becca pointed out, you know, how so many people in the Civil War, that God was on the side of the North or on the side of the South, depending whom you were, and the other side was totally demonized. As the second inaugural says, both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes God's aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. Close quote. An unwillingness to demonize the enemy, to recognize, as he points out again in the letter to Albert Hodges, there's fault and guilt and complicity on both sides. And I quote again that letter that was given to us by Dr. White in his talk. Quote, if God now wills removal of a great wrong and wills also that we of the North, as well as you of the South, shall pay fairly for our complicity in that wrong, impartial history will find therein new cause to attest and revere the justice and the goodness of God. Close quote. We too had complicity in the wrong of the war, Lincoln says. So in conclusion, then, there is no doubt that Lincoln believes in the providence of a God and that God works in history. But he reminds every one of us today of the danger that we believers can too readily, quickly, and with great certitude claim to know what God is doing in this world. And now my other authority, Becca obviously said the same thing when they knew too much about the North and the South, and that marvelous word that Dr. White used, the ambiguity of Lincoln. So I close then, the Almighty has her own purposes. Let God be God.
I'd like to ask Ron and the rest of the panel, with respect to Lincoln's religious odyssey, the focus has been entirely on God and almost nothing said on Jesus or the Holy Spirit. Ron, you made reference to Lincoln's using the word Savior. My friend Lane asked me at the break, did Lincoln ever profess and acknowledge Christ as his Lord and Savior? I want you to speak to that. But also in this context of I am an instrument in the hands of the Almighty, what exactly did Lincoln say about ever feeling any nudgings of the Holy Spirit in the context of fulfilling his responsibilities as leader?
The common supposition is that Lincoln never mentioned Jesus, and that's simply not true. He didn't mention Jesus often. He usually spoke of God. I'm not sure if he spoke of the Spirit or Holy Spirit. And in his journey, he spoke of Jesus in a number of times and places. For example, in 1842, he was asked to give an address to a new temperance organization called the Washingtonians, formed after George Washington. And to the great, Lincoln was very aware of the misuse of religion. That's kind of a subtext of all three things that we've been saying here, all three of us. And so he began to review the story of the temperance movements, which grew out of evangelical revivalism, the Second Great Awakening. He was quite critical of them because he said, how is it that one comes to someone who's in a struggle, in this case struggling with alcoholism, and the only thing you can offer to this person is denunciation? He said, what this person needs is friendship. You'll never reach a person by denunciation, only by friendship. And then he said, and the analogy is, and I wish I could get the words exactly, Jesus' death upon the cross is the analogy by which we should therefore reach out to others. That Jesus' death is a self-giving death for others. And therefore, he says, if we want to reach the alcoholic, the drunkard, as they said in those days, we have to be people who are willing to reach out without any denunciation. Well, after this address, he was really criticized by the religious leaders of Springfield because he was taking issue with the temperance society movement. But they missed the point that his analogy was exactly how Jesus responds to people. I'm not aware, Talmadge, of his talking about the Holy Spirit. I'm not. I'm not the authority here. I'm just not aware of that. No.
Another question. in thinking about Lincoln's anti-slavery positions, you've spoken at great length and very helpfully about how Lincoln would have recourse to the scriptures, particularly in considering providence. But I don't recall that Lincoln had the same sort of recourse to the scriptures in thinking about the institution of slavery and the personhood of the enslaved person. Lincoln, as I recall, thinks much more, or argues much more along the lines of nature, and what nature's God has to say about the personhood of all individuals. Would you comment, does Lincoln have recourse to the scriptures, and maybe particularly to the first chapter of Genesis, our being made in the image of God?
Let me use this as an occasion to point up another characteristic of Lincoln. Willie Herndon, his legal partner, was a very strong anti-slavery advocate. And he subscribed to all these anti-slavery newspapers, and he wanted to be sure that Lincoln read them. But then Lincoln suggested that they ought to subscribe to the Charleston Mercury and the Richmond, and Herndon said, why would you do that? He says, it's very, very important to be able to listen and to hear what the other side is saying in their own words. So in 1857, a man by the name of Ross gave a series of lectures which became a best-selling book, Slavery Ordained by God. And that book is filled with scriptural references. Lincoln purchases a copy of the book. He writes his own notes to it. He is appalled by it. And he one by one takes apart Ross's reasoning from scripture. Lincoln was opposed by probably 20 of the 23 pastors who voted in 1860 for the presidential election. You knew how people voted. You would often come and have to stand before the elector and record your vote as a voice vote. So he really did use scripture in many ways, but he was especially appalled by those who tried to use scripture to defend slavery.
According to the Book of Life, that contains the narratives of Sojourner Truth, Abraham Lincoln was presented by the African Americans of Baltimore, some of the African Americans of Baltimore, with a Bible. Can you tell us if that Bible still exists, and can you also give a little bit of the circumstances surrounding this remarkable gift?
Lincoln received this gift in, I think it was August of 1863, from the leaders of Baltimore. This is a helpful reminder. We have had in the last 35 years a pushback from some in the African American community, led by Lerone Bennett and his book, Forced into Glory, Abraham Lincoln's Views on Slavery, in which Abraham Lincoln is not a friend. But this negates the fact that generations of African Americans after the Civil War would have had a photograph of Lincoln, would have had the painting of Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation. That Bible has been, I think still is, at Fisk University in their library. And Lincoln offers his comment, his commendation to them on the use of the Bible. I think it's a very important statement.
Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, but the definition of odyssey means a wandering without a specific destination in mind, whereas the definition of pilgrimage reflects a journey for which there is a specific destination in mind. That's the way I read Webster's, and I may be wrong. If I am, please correct me. But if those are accurate definitions, why do you refer to Lincoln's religious journey as an odyssey as opposed to a pilgrimage?
This is why I come and give presentations. I get corrected. Good point. I guess I've used pilgrimage, journey, odyssey kind of interchangeably. I take your point. I don't want to say, though, that Lincoln knew the end from the beginning in the pilgrimage. I don't want to make that point. Maybe journey is a better word to use than odyssey.
Yeah, I was just a little uncomfortable with wandering.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in quite that way, yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the impact of the war on Lincoln's development of his spirituality? I mean, it had to be just crushing to sit in his chair and watch the nation get blown apart, literally. What impact did that have on accelerating his faith maturity?
I just want to say two things about that. One is, we were talking earlier, one of the things that I find really interesting about Lincoln is, on the one hand, he had this strong sense of, God's will is it's carrying out and we're instruments of God's will. On the other hand, Lincoln is running around trying to do everything he can to kick his generals in the backside and get them to, get made to, pursue Lee after Gettysburg. So on the one hand, he has this sense of, we really are limited in what we can do. This is God's will is carrying forth. On the other hand, he's very much an activist in trying to make things happen. So it's interesting to see just the burden that he felt on him to do his part as the instrument of God's will in the war. And I think just, I was saying earlier, and I think this response in some ways to Talmadge's question, not simply about Lincoln talking about the spirit, but you really do see in those last couple of years this, it's like it's a crucible for Lincoln. And with the tragedies of the war and the burden of the leadership and the decisions he's having to make, plus Willie's his son's death, and it appears, he's having these dreams that, he thinks may be foretelling something that's going on. So he's got all this stuff happening. And it does seem to me like he was having some sort of, and he even made comments to friends, some sense of sort of God's hand on him and some experiences of God. So it's not simply, these sort of what you see in his sort of theology as it matures may not simply be sort of a increased sort of intellectual sophistication about theology, but also something that's going on him in this crucible with all this tragedy and this despair and this unknown, the unknown of the future, and also whatever experiences he's having of the divine or of the spirit, or however you want to say it.
Well, in this Methodist audience, I need to say to any audience, Calvinism has often been so caricatured and misunderstood. The Puritans said, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. So what Becca is saying here is that Lincoln's pointing beyond himself to the providence of God is in no way saying, therefore, I'm just sitting back and waiting for this to happen. And he says in the Meditation on the Divine Will, notice how clearly he says this. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities, you and me, working just as they do, are of the best adaptation to effect his purpose. And also picking up that Charlie's wonderful comments and large frame reference of this, I was thinking of it when Lincoln traveled from Springfield to Washington. He gives this marvelous speech in Trenton, New Jersey, to the state legislature, in which he says, I am a humble instrument in this almost chosen people. Well, see, the absolutists would have said, in this chosen people, isn't it? No, we're almost chosen. Oh, if I had one question to ask Lincoln, I want to ask him, what do you mean almost? I think he thinks we're almost because of the terrible specter of slavery. That's why we're almost. We have never put this issue behind us as a moral issue. I think you probably answered your own question that Lincoln's spiritual quest is not odyssey, but journey, is think of our own lives when we are impacted by tragedy, the death of a child, divorce, the loss of a job, the loss of a parent, whatever it is. It often forces us to ask these kind of ultimate questions. So I'm presuming that this forces Lincoln to ask these kind of questions, perhaps in a way he didn't ask them when he was traveling out on the 8th Judicial Circuit as a kind of a successful lawyer in the middle of rural Illinois. He wasn't forced to ask them, but now he's got to ask them.
Fitting that a student of ours gets to ask the last question. So,
in the 21st century, we're reading out Lincoln's life and his legacy in such a powerful way, in such a spiritual way. But in his lifetime, how many people really saw him as a strong spiritual person versus a person much more concerned about the Union, much more political, and using self-deprecating language to simply convey to the country a reason to come together?
It's a wonderful question. Several ways to look at that. On the one hand, I've tried to present the argument here that until the second inaugural, there is not a full focus on Lincoln's spirituality. No one knew of the meditation on the divine will. Having said that, immediately afterwards, on that Sunday, Lincoln began to be portrayed as a Christ figure in the pulpits of the Protestant churches. Now, they were very upset that he went to the theater on Good Friday, and they couldn't forgive him for that. But so this begins to happen. And then there is this movement to Christianize Lincoln. That's actually the language. So what I haven't said in my presentations today is that one of the reasons I think that we have not focused on Lincoln's spirituality is that we did it 30 or 40 years ago not very well. And the academic scholars became aware that preachers who were writing about Lincoln were very uncritically picking up pieces of reminiscence. I mean, I had a number of people come up to me after lunch today and share with me story after story after story of Lincoln. I felt so bad to say, I don't think that that's true. There's no way we can validate that. You know, it was disappointing. And the greatest story of all is the fact that at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, the story still present today is that he was planning to join the church on Easter Sunday, April 16. How do we know that? Gurley, the minister, died in 1868. In 1894, Gurley's daughter said, my father told me that Lincoln was going to join the church in 1865 on April 16. You're telling me in 1894, but you've never said anything for 30 years? So we have to be careful, and therefore in my biography, there were a lot of stories that would have almost advanced this journey further, and I said, I can't use it. I can't use this one. I can't use this one. I can't use this. I can't use this one because these really are more reminiscences, but they don't really. It's hard to validate that they really are true.